as Tommy came bounding back over in time with the music. He'd picked 60 Minute Man. I hate that song. 7.
Space spending called austere. Clemens opens fight for budget. Reduction suggested priority for tax cut. By John W. Finney, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, December 4th, 1961. The International Aerospace Coalition opened its fight to a skeptical Congress today, asking for a $5.7 billion contribution to the United Nations space budget, warning that any substantial cuts would jeopardize the planned manned expedition to Mars. There are widespread misgivings bordering on resistance about giving the agency another budget increase, with members of Congress saying that the United States has borne a disproportionate share of the costs of the space program. Behind this skepticism are a combination of factors ranging from such earthly concerns as tax cuts to concern about national objectives in space.
It would have, apparently, been too much to ask for me to be able to concentrate on training. Instead, for the past 3 months, I had to cram on a diet of IAC binders while flying between training and publicity opportunities. I was in one of the classrooms with the rest of the team to learn about geology. A case of rocks sat in front of me with numbers painted on them. It wasn't going to be enough to tell Mission Control that we'd found something red and crumbly on Mars. We needed to be able to say that it was hypidiomorphic granular, porphyritic, with medium-grained red phenocrysts. Leonard was in his element. He picked over the case of minerals that the instructor had given him, grinning. He leaned over to me with a lump of red rock in his hand.
Doing okay?
Trying to be. I grimaced at the evaluation sheet I was supposed to be filling out. There was so much to memorize along every axis of the trip.
Okay.
He pointed to a line of deeper red in the rock I was staring at.
This is pyroxene, which we think we might see.
A quick knock at the door interrupted him, and Betty stuck her head in. Hi, sorry to interrupt, but I need to borrow Elma real quick. Well, I'm glad someone can use her, Florence muttered, glaring at her notebook. I sighed and clenched the rock I was holding like it was a security blanket. Can't it wait?
Sorry, it's just that the BBC wants you. It won't take long, I promise.
She leaned farther into the room and caught Parker's eye with a wink.
You can catch her up, right?
He shrugged in response. I wasn't sure if that meant yes or that he didn't care. Wouldn't they like someone else? Why did it always have to be me? Leonard, you already know this stuff.
They want photos of you with Nathaniel.
Betty winced apologetically.
Sorry, but we're working the whole husband and wife angle.
Florence leaned over to Leonard. I don't think she meant to speak loud enough for me to hear, but I did.
At least she can't use us as shields this time.
I set the rock down. What's that supposed to mean? She pursed her lips and turned to stare at me with hazel eyes over a long patrician nose. She kept her dark hair straightened, and the neat bob framed her disapproval.
You really want to have this conversation now?
Now we're in space. Better now. 2, 3, 5, 7, 11.
All right. A world's fair in space, please. There are 6 colored astronauts in the entire program.
Yes, and I'm trying to celebrate you. The IAC was discriminatory in its early days, and I worked hard to...
You worked hard.
She snorted and glanced at Leonard.
And I didn't? Leonard and Ida and Imogene and Eugene and Myrtle didn't? Helen didn't work hard.
Of course you did. 13, 17, 23. I took a slow breath and tried to ignore the fact that everyone in the room was staring at us. That's why I'm talking about how you're here, so that y'all don't get shoved into the background. I'm trying to help.
You know what would help? If you'd learned to do your damn job.
She turned back to the rocks on her desk.
Better run now. Don't want to keep the photographers waiting.
There were a half dozen things I could have said, but I just bit my tongue hard and pushed back my chair. Here's the interesting thing. You don't have to like someone to work well with them. In fact, in some ways, it's more efficient when you aren't paired with someone whose company you enjoy. because both of you have a vested interest in finishing tasks as quickly as possible in order to minimize contact. When you're with a friend, there's likely to be joking or goofing around. By this measure, I could be efficiently paired with half of the Mars team. Okay, that's an exaggeration. But it did feel like everyone was angry at me. And honestly, I couldn't blame them. It was bad enough that I was a late addition and had to do a ton of catching up. But the way that I was being trotted around like a dog and pony show, that wasn't something an astronaut assigned to a mission was supposed to be doing. It meant that everyone else had to cover for me. Cover for me more. As we walked down the hall, away from the classroom, Betty glanced over at me. "You okay?"
"Sure,"
I chirped. I tried to put it off. Honest.
"I know. It's just, I'm already struggling to catch up."
Betty nodded with a grimace.
"I'm refusing most interview requests. Believe it or not, it's just,
I know. This is why I'm on the team."
She led me to the room that PR had co-opted as a makeup and prep room. With a sigh, I settled in front of the mirror and let other people worry about my makeup and hair while I concentrated on my binder of information, without the benefit of the rock samples. On Mars, we'd need to know how to look for potential water flow. That could be identified by small laminations or cross-stratification that showed festoon geometry from transport in subaqueous ripples. I rubbed my forehead, and the makeup lady gently pulled my hand away.
"Mustn't smudge."
Right. My priorities were a mess. In the mirror, it looked as though I were going to a holiday party wearing a flight suit. My hair fell in perfect soft curls that would never have survived if I'd actually been working. In Sims and on the moon, I tended to keep it out of the way in a kerchief. But accuracy wasn't the image that publicity had wanted. The makeup lady spun the chair around to release me, and like a trained hound, I followed Betty down the hall to the engineering wing. Annoyed as I was, I still felt lighter when we rounded the corner into Nathaniel's office. Someone had cleaned it. An orchid sat on his desk, and a lamp warmed the corner by his drafting table. They hadn't made him change clothes, though. He wore his tweed jacket and a plain blue tie that, on second thought, I didn't recognize the tie, but it brought out his eyes. They lit up when he saw me.
"Hello, Dr. York."
"Good morning, Dr. York." I stifled the urge to kiss him on the cheek, less because of the photographer and the reporter, and more because I didn't want to leave a giant red stain on his face. The reporter, a white man in his mid-50s, rested a notepad on his paunch as he scribbled.
"I'll try not to take up much of your time. Jerry, how do you want them?"
"Natural. How do you two usually work together?"
We didn't. Not these days, at any rate. I glanced at Nathaniel and shrugged. "What are you working on?" He went around to his desk and sat down. The desk drawer squeaked as he dragged it open.
"I was reviewing the flight plans for the supply ships to Mars."
As he laid the folder on the desk, I went around to stand behind him. Leaning over his shoulder, I studied the equations and once again felt out of touch. I rested a hand on his back, frowning as I tried to figure out what AMZ squared referred to. A flash went off.
"Try to look happy."
Jerry, the photographer, leaned in closer. Behind the camera, his lank black hair draped across his forehead. I smiled. That damn regulation smile. Everything is wonderful, and I just love outer space. Don't you? Flash. I couldn't see the numbers on the page through the purple splotches floating in my vision. Flash. 2, 3, 5, 7.
"Dr. York. Elma. May I call you Elma?"
The photographer didn't wait for a response. He just came forward and patted the edge of the desk.
"Can I have you sit on the desk? I love the costume you have on, and I can't really see it behind your husband. Nathaniel, right? Great. Right here. Good. Perfect."
I sat on the desk, which made it hard to look at the equations, but no more awkward than being in one of the early capsules.
"Is there something more sciencey you could do?"
The reporter stepped forward, tapping his pencil on his notepad.
I mean, you could be looking at tax returns here.
Nathaniel looked down at the equations, which were really science-y, and rubbed the back of his neck.
I just sent all of the models over for wind tunnel tests. Blueprints?
What about one of these? Betty pulled a punch card out of a box sitting on the edge of the desk.
Don't.
Nathaniel pulled it out of her hand.
Don't get them out of sequence.
The reporter's eyes rounded at the side of the card as if Nathaniel had said nothing.
Oh, that's perfect. Better than a model which any kid could put together. But programming an electronic computer, that's science with a capital S.
Jerry focused the camera on us.
Why don't you show it to your wife, Nate? Like you're explaining it to her.
Nathaniel shot me a look, brows raised as if he were trying to figure out if that was a serious question. This really wasn't any worse than powdering my nose in a T-38. I leaned closer to him, a laugh bubbling right at the back of my throat. Yes, sweetie, tell me what crucial piece of programming you have. I batted my eyes at him. Nathaniel burst out laughing, holding the card up as if it were somehow meaningful by itself. It was a tiny part of a larger program with as much relevance as an individual bolt. The spacecraft might fall apart without it, but it didn't define the thing. The camera whirred and flashed and caught me with an unguarded, non-regulation smile. That's the photo they wound up using, billed as the joy of spaceflight. But we were laughing at the utter lack of science, while back in the classroom, my teammates were learning actual science. If they really wanted something more science-y, they would have taken photos in that room. Instead, they had pulled me out of the pile and turned me into something as useful as an individual punch card. The thing about wearing a spacesuit on Earth is that it's designed for lower gravity. Even being in the neutral buoyancy lab's pool didn't change the fact that gravity pulled at me. Sure, it didn't pull at the suit, but inside it, I slid around every time I changed orientation. As a woman, I was smaller than the men the suits had been designed for, so I had to wear padding around my hips to sort of wedge me in. This kept the air bubble surrounding me inside the suit distributed evenly, allowing me to move from horizontal to vertical over the course of the NBL run without fighting gravity. Without the padding, the air bubble acted like a giant beach ball strapped to my stomach, always wanting to be pointed up to the surface. It made it difficult to roll any other way. In truth, having an air bubble inside the suit wouldn't be a problem in space, but the NBL was where people decided if you had what it took to do a spacewalk. So neither I nor any of the other women would complain. No, sir, everything was splendid, and we were happy to be in the pool. I hung sideways in the water, with a fiberglass shell digging into my armpit. My neck burned from holding my head up inside my helmet. My fingers ached from forcing my stiff gloves to close on the edge of the solar panel we were practicing repairing. With the suits pressurized to 4.9 psi above ambient pressure, every movement felt like working against a heavy-duty spring. It wasn't exactly like working in a vacuum, but it gave us a sense of how exhausting it would be. A wrinkle in my glove felt like a metal wire across my knuckle as the pressure made it rigid. But if you asked me how I was doing, I would have been so very, very chipper. On the other side of the panel, Rafael Avelino swore in Portuguese as his gloves slid off the wrench. Our support divers floated in a pod around us and let the wrench drift away. Their job was to keep us safe, and ours was to learn how to do repairs in zero-G. Tethered to the MWS, or mini workstation, on the chest of a spacesuit, the wrench didn't go far, but it was still a pain reeling it in. As Rafael's curses buzzed over the comm, I grinned inside my helmet. I'm beginning to understand why Parker is learning Portuguese. On my left and slightly below me, Leonard helped me steady the panel as Rafael got the wrench back into place.
We'll need more languages to swear in. I've just got Latin and Greek, and there's only so far that can take you.
Oh, yeah? What's a Latin curse like?
Rafael placed the wrench again and reseated his feet in the foot restraint, secured in a WIF mechanical receptor on the mock-up exterior of our craft. What does WIF stand for? No idea. At a certain point, the acronyms just become the name. WIF was Widget Interface Forget About It. One of the many benefits to building the ships in space was that we didn't have to worry about aerodynamics. WIFs and grips covered the surface of the ship. Hafael's wrench slipped again, but he didn't lose his grasp.
Because I could use some more now.
Leonard hesitated and then chuckled.
Actually, most of them aren't things I can say in mixed company.
Please. I braced against my foot restraint as Hafael finally got the wrench engaged. Say the fucking Latin. Matt got a huge laugh from both men, though my face flamed at having said it. Thank God the helmets meant they couldn't see me clearly. Even for a laugh, that kind of language was still not in my normal vocabulary. And then, predictably, Jason Sow, our sim soup du jour, crackled into our ears.
Language. Vae me puto concacavi me.
Leonard intoned with great solemnity. Hafael's head came up in his helmet.
Huh. That is close enough to Portuguese that I actually understood it. Mostly. Gentlemen. Lady.
For a guy from Chicago, Sal could be so prim sometimes.
We have visitors, and they are listening.
The three of us exchanged glances, and Hafael rolled his eyes.
What language do they speak? English.
Through the microphone, we could just make out someone talking in the background, but not the substance of the conversation. The Simsoup's response was sharp and biting.
No. Bringing them up early is absolutely out of the...
And then his mic cut off. What had that been? Through the water, I couldn't see what the guys thought, so I just stood there bracing the panel. It wasn't like the Simsoup to leave his mic open, which raised the question of what sort of visitors would distract him that badly, to say nothing of who might be asking us to come out of the NBL run early. Hafael got that bolt tightened down, and we moved on as a unit to extend the next piece of the panel. This was the fourth time we'd done this particular NBL run, and each time we got a little faster. Of course, it wasn't likely that I would be the one doing the EVA, but the IAC believed in over-preparation, and after my late start, I supported them in that. Besides, it would make being the IV person, the intravehicular person, easier if I knew what they were facing. Given the communication lags we would have during the mission, we couldn't rely on ground control to coach the EV team in every scenario.
Folks, we're going to stand down on extending the array.
The Sim Soup's voice crackled, then the microphone rustled and shifted as though he were handing it off. We floated underwater with the constant hum of fans and the sound of our own breath as company. Then Director Clemens came on the comm.
We have to pull Dr. Flattery out. But Dr. York and Captain Avellino will stay and work through the cleanup. Dr. Flattery, I need you out of the tank, pronto.
Leonard drew a breath as if he were going to argue, then snapped his mouth shut so hard I heard his teeth click.
Yes, sir. See you topside.
I am ashamed to say that my primary emotion was not curiosity or even annoyance that our training had been interrupted, but relief that, for once, it wasn't me. Leonard turned from us and let the divers drag him through the water to the platform that would carry him to the surface. Hafael and I floated in the pool. I let my head slump against the side of my helmet and closed my eyes for a moment while our support divers reconfigured the ship mock-up to the end state of the run. It took so long to get into the suits that it made sense to let us practice the end of the run while we were already down there. I kept listening to the comm, waiting for Tsao to tell us something else about what was happening with Leonard. When the divers were ready for us, we started the run again but kept conversation to the bare minimum required for work. After I got over my relief, I had a huge case of, what the devil is going on? I'd been pulled out of training before, but not an actual NBL run. That required restarting the entire thing, which was expensive and an enormous loss of training time. Heck, the way the suits were configured, it took 2 days just to replace a crew member. Short of a medical emergency or an equipment malfunction, nothing interrupted an NBL run. So what would Clemens think was so important that it couldn't wait? And why weren't they telling us? The lift out of the NBL's pool took ages. As my helmet breached the surface of the water, the stand I was strapped to supported the 140 kilograms of my suit. Trying to walk in a full suit in Earth gravity is not possible. Even just the bottoms are like... It's like wearing diapers in a snowsuit made of lead. The robot in Lost in Space had more grace than we did. I hung in the donning stand as a swarm of suit techs helped us to disrobe. When you want answers, everything seems to take longer. I waited for my suit tech to remove the tools and tethers and leg weights. As much as I wanted to rush her, everything had to be done in sequence. On the other side of the donning stand, Raphael was going through the same slow, careful extraction from his spacesuit. It was like my suit tech was moving underwater as she opened the valve on the side to depressurize the spacesuit down to below one. Sure, I could talk now and she could hear me, along with everyone else listening in on the comms. My suit tech put her hands on the release of my glove. Breathe out. I exhaled as the remaining bit of delta pressure released when she popped the glove. It wasn't likely that I would blow out a lung, but over-precautions were IAC's stock in trade. The suit settled around me as she pulled the glove away. Then finally, she reached for the helmet. The moment it was off, I asked her, "What's going on?" "FBI." She glanced over her shoulder to the control room. "We were told to get you cleaned up fast." I blinked like an idiot for a minute, before my brain joined my body above water. If they wanted to talk to Leonard and me, then it must be related to the protesters, but it had been nearly 7 months since the hijacking. Why on earth would they want to talk to us now? 8.
Exemplars of Society Charged with Holding Up Racial Gains by Fred Powledge. Kansas City, Kansas, January 4th, 1962. A leading civil rights lawyer has charged that the exemplars of our society are guilty of resisting the federal constitution. The lawyer, Jack Greenberg, director counsel of the NAACP, Legal Defense and Educational Fund, said in the fund's annual report, "Those who would maintain the racial caste system have resisted the Constitution and court rulings by force, by deceit, by tokenism, by stalling litigation, and by such legislative maneuvers as the filibuster. Sadly, those responsible for these evasions are exemplars of our society. School and university board members, superintendents of education, leaders of the bar, astronauts, and elected officials."
When I was finally escorted into the conference room, one of the FBI agents rose to greet me. He was a painfully slender man with cheekbones that looked as if they would puncture his parchment skin.
"Dr. York, I'm Agent Boone. This is my colleague, Agent Whitaker."
Agent Whitaker stayed seated, scribbling in a notebook, and barely glanced up. He had generic white bread good looks, marred by an ugly red scar across his forehead just below his hairline. Boone glanced at his colleague and gave a little shrug as if he were used to the man's rudeness.
"Thank you for making the time to meet with us."
Did I have a choice? I smiled to take the sting away, but I was more than a little annoyed. After rushing me out of the sim, they had kept me waiting for an hour and a half. Honestly, it was a little bit of a relief to have some time to just sit and read.
"Well, we'll try to get you out of here as quickly as possible."
He gestured across the conference table to a chair facing them.
"Please, coffee?"
"Thank you. That would be lovely." I did not comment on the fact that he was serving me coffee from the IAC's own stock. "Cream and sugar, if you don't mind."
"I have a sweet tooth, so let me know if I go overboard."
He snagged his mug off the table and walked to the back of the room.
"We have some questions about the rocket crash and the men who held you."
"Of course. Though I'm not certain there's anything I can tell you that I didn't already say in debriefing." Whitaker drew a harsh line on his notebook, but still didn't look at me.
"Oh, I think there is."
"I'll be interested to hear what you think that is." I kept my hands in my lap, resting gently together the way my mother had taught me. The fact that I was wearing trousers instead of a skirt would have appalled her,
but the general appearance of ladylike refinement was still a good tool. From the back of the room, Boone poured a generous amount of sugar into my coffee cup.
Well, let's start with establishing some parameters.
Now you sound like a rocket scientist. He chuckled, and the parchment of his skin folded into deep creases around his mouth.
I wish I were that bright.
Whittaker shot a quick look toward his partner.
You and me both.
He shoved his notebook away.
How long have you known Leonard Flannery?
I opened and shut my mouth like a fish. That was not at all what I thought they'd ask. I'd been expecting to review conversations or go over some bit of minutiae. 2 years-ish? I squinted, trying to remember which class he'd been in. Yes, he was hired with the class of 59 recruits, I think. HR should be able to tell you.
But you'd never met him before he joined the IAC.
Boone set my coffee cup down in front of me, steam curling off its surface. That's right. I kept my hands in my lap and didn't reach for the cup. Not that he would actually have laced it with anything, but the topic choice made me feel suddenly unsafe. Why do you ask?
Can you talk to us about his temperament during the time you've known him?
I'm sorry. I thought we were here to talk about the rocket crash. Whittaker tipped his chair back.
What's his temperament like?
What the hell? You just spent an hour and a half with him. How did you find him? Whittaker dropped the chair forward, resting his elbows on the table.
Why are you refusing to answer questions, Dr. York?
John.
Agent Boone pulled out the chair next to me and sat down.
Sorry. The investigation has been a long process. We know that you aren't required to answer any questions, but we'd greatly appreciate your cooperation. What's your experience with Dr. Flannery been like?
The fact that he was polite didn't make me feel any better about his line of questioning. Completely congenial. Prior to my assignment to the Mars mission, he and I didn't cross paths much, but I've never heard even a cross word from him. Nor have I heard of anyone else experiencing anything like that. Boone sipped his coffee, seemingly at ease.
No signs of discontent?
No. I picked up my cup more for the warmth of the mug than anything else. My hands had gone cold, and the slick porcelain seared my palms. Nodding, Boone looked over at Whittaker and shrugged. Whatever that meant, it caused Whittaker to pick up his notepad and flip back a few pages.
Flannery spoke to the terrorists at length. What did he say?
Boone leaned forward, resting a hand on the desk.
We want to confirm a witness statement without compromising your own testimony, so just repeat whatever you recall to the best of your ability.
I blinked at him, uncertain what he wanted. At length? I don't... I shook my head, trying to rattle memories out of the corners. I don't remember them talking much after they first came on the ship. He tried to talk them down, convince them not to go through with the plan.
Why do you think he felt comfortable talking to them?
I narrowly avoided saying, because Roy was black, which was, I was certain, the answer they were looking for. Instead, I shrugged. Because he was across the aisle from me and they had stopped there to talk to me? And I'm not sure I would characterize either of us as comfortable. Boone took a sip of his coffee, which I half expected to stain his cadaverous cheeks from the inside.
Why don't you read that quote to Dr. York?
Nodding, Whittaker put a finger on his notepad to mark his spot.
Did you hear him say, I agree with what you are doing and I'm trying to help?
What? No! They were trying to paint him as a collaborator. The closest he said to that was that... But he had, in fact, said that he agreed with the why of what they were doing.
Yes, Dr. York.
He was trying to keep them from using me as a hostage. He thought it would make things worse. That's all the help he was offering. The same sort of thing that I was doing. He wasn't collaborating with them. Whittaker made a mark in his notebook. The silver barrel of his pen gleamed like a rocket as it scratched a trail of ink across the page. To my right, Boone sipped his coffee, watching me over the rim.
You can't seriously think he was involved with the crash.
They had no understanding of how rockets worked if they thought that he could affect the flight from the passenger compartment.
He's a geologist.
How is that relevant?
Whitaker lifted his head.
Because he's not a pilot.
I looked from one man to the other, trying to get them to understand just how off course their trajectory was.
He can talk about rocks and find groundwater, and he's good at a half dozen other things. But he couldn't have done anything to affect where we came down.
We never said he did.
Whitaker looked back down at his paper.
Change of subject. Tell us about the co-pilot. Willard Brumwell.
I nearly spilled my coffee as things clicked into place. Brumwell was black, too.
He's a good man.
I'm sure he is.
Boone's parchment cheeks creased with a smile.
How long have you known him?
I carefully set my coffee cup on the table in the middle of the condensation ring it had left.
You said I didn't have to answer any questions, so if you'll excuse me, gentlemen, I've got work to finish up.
As I pushed my chair back, Boone set his own cup on the table and ran a finger around the rim.
Director Clemens wants you to cooperate with us fully.
He looked up, smiling.
We're trying to find some answers. I'm sure you recognize how important it is for Congress to have a full understanding before they deliberate on budget issues.
Bastards. Why did it always come back to funding? As much as I wanted to drop out of their orbit, they were making it pretty clear that they'd try to ground all of us. I pulled my chair back to the table, feeling as queasy as an astronaut's first day on Earth.
All right. What can I tell you?
I honestly don't know how Leonard kept working after the FBI incident. I had a hard time concentrating, as I waited for the other shoe to drop, and yet, nothing. Weeks went past, and we just kept going with the routines of classes and sims. In the mock cockpit of the simulated Mars Command Module, Parker sat in the captain's chair and scowled.
Right. We've just lost contact with Mission Control.
We all groaned at the latest green card that our simulation supervisor had just thrown our way, but not too loudly because, of course, the SimSoup was sitting just outside in the white room control area, monitoring our test.
We've got the Transmars burn coming up,
Terraza said from the co-pilot seat, which meant that I was up. This was why they had a NavComp on board, in case we lost contact with Mission Control. I'll calculate the burn.
Roger.
Parker nodded from his seat, continuing his job of keeping our craft flying on course. I fumbled with the sextant, trying to sight it on the simulated stars outside our simulated window to calculate our simulated position. If only my uncertainty had been simulated as well. This procedure is supposed to be simple. I find the three stars that the IAC had been using for this flight, sight the sextant on them, and voila! I know where up is, which then allows me to know how we're doing in relation to the original flight plan that the IAC had sent. If we were off, then I could calculate where our engine needed to point and for how long. But I had to find the stars that the IAC had chosen when they'd sent the last course adjustment in order to compare them with the tables that Mission Control had prepared for just such a contingency. So, which one was Alcade? Find the Little Dipper, then Arc to Arcturus, speed on to Spica, and... okay. Found that, which meant that Alcade was... where? I ground my teeth and tried to pull the memory out of my brain. The thing is that star charts in a book are very different from the actual stars, which are different again from simulated ones. If I'd stayed at Adler during sextant training... but I hadn't.
Clock's ticking, York.
I nodded and named the stars that I knew in that region, hoping that I'd be able to identify Alcade in the process. Gina, Acrux, Spica, Menkent, which meant that one was Alcade. I sighted the sextant on it and then began my calculations.
5 minutes in, I realized that the numbers were too far off for that to have been right. One of the stars I'd picked must be wrong. I was confident about Spica, but Alcade. I could try again, but the clock was ticking, and if this happened for real, the best scenario is that it would be embarrassing. The more likely outcome was that I would send us out of the narrow flight path. We'd miss Mars, and we'd all die. If I were uncertain in space, I'd ask for help. Sighing, I lifted my head from my calculations. Can someone point out Alcade for me? On it. Florence slid over and laid her cheek next to mine so that our sight lines were as close as possible. Squinting, she pointed to a star 3 over from the one I'd picked.
That one. Forms the corner of a right angle, see?
The image from the textbook suddenly snapped into focus. Yes, thank you.
Anything I can do to keep you from killing us?
She slid back to her seat and took up her position again. I wish she had been joking. The UN security team escorted me past the photographers outside our building and all the way up the stairs to our apartment door. Exhausted, I still remembered my mother's training. Thanks. Can I get you something to drink?
No, ma'am.
He smiled and patted the back of the chair we'd put in the hall.
I've got a good book, and my relief comes soon enough.
Well, holler if you need anything. My life was so odd. The itch of leaving someone to sit in our hallway didn't quite fade, even when I was in the apartment with the door closed behind me. Nathaniel sat at the kitchen table, twirling a pencil in one hand while he hunched over a stack of papers. Our Murphy bed had already been pulled down, covers turned back, so it took up half of our studio. Still, the room looked so big after my quarters on the moon. As I shut the door, Nathaniel looked up, smiling.
I was wondering if they'd let you go.
Well, I killed us, so the sim stopped, otherwise we'd still be at it. That damn artificial starfield kept tripping me up. We're running it again tomorrow. The smile on his face froze for a moment before he inhaled and laughed at the joke that was supposed to have been. Sliding his chair back, he stood.
Have you eaten?
Yes, but only rations as part of the sim. Coming all the way into the kitchen area, I set my binder down on the table. How do you define knowing that your husband is hiding something? A slight stiffness in his features? A delay in reactions? As if he's thinking about the correct thing to say or do? The way he moves with his back to you, with the pretense of opening the refrigerator? Are you all right? They pulled the freezer door open.
I've got some soup, too, but I thought you might need one of these.
Nathaniel turned around, holding 2 martinis, glass frosted from sitting in the freezer. He winked.
You'll be happy to know that rationing has been lifted enough so that gin is no longer worth its weight in gold.
Forget the gin. I took the glass from his hand, sighing in relief at the slick, cold glass. Where did you get the olives?
Governor Wargan.
He took a sip, and some of the tension in his frame eased.
Won them on poker night.
I'd forgotten, somehow, that he and the other astronauts' husbands played poker while we were up. How's Renard? I mean, with... I gestured at my binder as if that explained the whole topic of Helen staying and me going. Nathaniel shrugged, a line appearing and disappearing between his brows.
He's glad to have her home. It's... Right, soup. I was going to feed you dinner.
I took a sip of the beautiful martini, watching him. He stood in front of the refrigerator, back to me, as he pulled out a pot. My sweet husband, pretending that nothing was wrong. I lowered my glass. Do you remember when I started seeing the therapist and didn't tell you? Nathaniel stopped moving, pot halfway to the counter.
Yes.
He straightened and set it on the stove with a clatter of metal on metal. So, will you tell me what's bothering you? He turned on the burner, striking a match to light the gas. With a soft whoomp, the blue flames caught and licked the bottom of the pot. Nathaniel reached for a wooden spoon from the pitcher of utensils by the stove.
Honestly, I would rather not.
Okay. The agreement sprang automatically from my lips. He didn't want to talk about it? Fine. We wouldn't. I bent my head to the martini again, letting the briny scent give me a landing place. Taking a sip, I sat down at the kitchen table, trying to concentrate on the cool, herbal sting of the gin and the salt from the olive. But goddammit, what was bothering him? He stood with his shoulders hunched a little over the stove as he stirred the soup.
What time do you have to be in tomorrow?
7 a.m. I pulled the papers he'd been working on closer to distract myself with some math. Contingency plans for mid-mission abort. Oh. Contingency plans. That was the IAC's covert way of saying, what do we do if someone dies? I set the martini down and stood. Walking over to the stove, I wrapped my arms around Nathaniel's waist and leaned into his warmth. I'm just going to remind you that simulations are so that we make the mistakes here. The thing that killed us today is one less thing that will catch us in space.
One less.
He stopped stirring the soup and wisps of steam curled around the edges of the deep red liquid. Through the back of his shirt, his breath hitched and caught. Nathaniel let go of the soup and brought both hands down to rest on mine.
Sorry, I thought...
Laying my cheek against his shoulder blade, I waited.
I thought I'd gotten used to it. Watching you launch into space, knowing the giant list of things that could fail.
One of his hands found my wedding ring and spun it.
But I know what can fail here. Out there, you might just never come home.
That is always true. I squeezed him tighter. I mean, I could be hit by a streetcar.
But I would know.
In the circle of my arms, he straightened with a little chuckle.
Golly, that sounds great. Gee, honey, you might die, but could you make sure I know the details? Thanks!
I snorted and rose onto my toes so I could kiss the back of his neck. You are a goof. I tugged at his waist. Come here.
Where?
Nathaniel wiped his face with one hand as he turned off the burner. I led him around the table to the bed and gave him the courtesy of not noticing that his eyes were red. In truth, I had no idea how to comfort him. With so many flights, Nathaniel could no longer oversee them all, and Clemens, bless him, decreed that he wasn't allowed to work mine. Although maybe that was a cruelty, because it took away his sense of being able to affect the outcome. This thing he was afraid of? It was very real. Le Bourgeois had died last year, when a faulty switch caused his retro rockets to misfire during a routine orbital adjustment. I pulled my husband down to sit on the bed, wrapped my arms around him, and just held him. After a moment, he leaned back, so that we both were lying on the bed, all tangled in each other. His face was close to mine, and those blue eyes rimmed in red searched me like a star chart. Nathaniel drew a line across my brows and down my cheek, leaving a trail of warmth behind.
I love you, and...
He stopped and closed his eyes, swallowing.
And that's why I don't want to talk about this. Because supporting you and being honest about... I don't know if I can.
My insides turned acrid with pain for him. I could only pull him closer and try not to cry because the last thing I wanted was for him to be comforting me when I was trying to comfort him. Of all the things we'd talked about when considering if I should go to Mars or stay on Earth, Nathaniel's fear had not been in the equation. It was a hidden variable that kept the whole thing from balancing. What can I do? He laughed breathlessly.
Don't die.
I'll try not to. Raising a hand, I traced circles on his arm. Anything else? Nathaniel sighed again.
The problem with being the lead engineer and married to an astronaut is that I know how you all lie on your reports about your health. You'll give us the brightest possible picture on anything you decide isn't mission critical.
I winced. He was not wrong. What about... He opened his eyes, and his pupils were as large and deep as space.
What about what?
Okay, this is stupid.
I don't get to see you be stupid very often without thrust involved.
I slid my hand down to his trousers to see if launch conditions had been met. Not yet, which meant that I needed to prime the fuel cells. Well, you mentioned the reports. What if I could give you private reports? Nathaniel rolled up onto his elbow.
Private reports, you say?
And then he shook his head.
No good. At the bandwidth you'll be broadcasting, everyone on Earth will know your business.
Not if it's a code.
The moment people see a code, someone is going to try to crack it.
Ah. I pushed myself up on my elbow so I could kiss him. This is where my work as a computer came in handy, combined with learning how the teletype systems would work on this mission. But if they don't see the code, they won't know there's anything to crack. For instance, say it's in the garbage at the beginning and end of a teletype transmission. Nathaniel stared at me for a moment, or rather, he stared in my direction. But given the line between his brows and the way his eyes darted back and forth like he was following a thought down a dark alley, I'm pretty sure he was programming a teletype. His focus snapped back, then he smiled and bent forward to kiss me. His mouth was warm and still tasted a little of gin. Elsewhere, thrusters came online and we were go for launch. 9.
Racial incidents at issue in UN. Kansas City, Kansas, March 24th, 1962. With tact and assurances, United States officials have been striving to placate Asian and African diplomats aroused over a series of unpleasant racial incidents in the city. Episodes involving non-white diplomats have stirred resentment in the international community here. The latest was the attack 2 weeks ago on Youssef Gueye, first secretary of the Mauritanian delegation. The French-speaking diplomat, out for an evening stroll, was accosted by a group of white youths. The group yelled at him, he said, and then he was hit with a beer bottle. He suffered facial cuts requiring hospital treatment.
Helen met me at her front door wearing a mint-green day dress and a strained smile. Thank you for coming over. We did not hug. It's good to see you. I'd seen her at work, of course, but we'd done nothing social since I'd replaced her. The invitation to come over for a bridge night had been a welcome surprise. May I offer you something to drink? She led me back down a short hallway to the living room. Florence Gray sat on the sofa, sipping a whiskey and soda. Oddly, the card table and chairs hadn't been set up yet. Helen walked over to the birch sideboard where a bucket of ice sat sweating on a silver tray. Martini? If it's not too much trouble, that would be lovely. I set my handbag on an end table. Good evening, Florence. York. She picked up her soda and sipped it, watching me over the rim. This was going to be a swell evening. The doorbell rang, which must be Ida. That offered me an excuse to flee for a moment. I'll get it. Helen nodded from the sideboard where she was measuring out vermouth to add to the pitcher. I retreated down the hall and pulled the door open. Ida stood on the little stoop of the Carmouches' home with a big grin and a basket of strawberries.
Elma! She gave me a quick hug. When are we going to get you back out to the 99's airfield for some flying? We all miss you.
You know how mission prep is. I gave a pained smile and glanced back toward the living room. Lowering my voice, I said, I don't want to talk about the mission, though. Helen, you know?
She grimaced. Sorry, I forgot.
Putting on a grin, she stepped past me and headed down the hall.
Ladies, I come bearing strawberries and shortcake.
You are a goddess among women.
Florence stood up from the table and greeted Ida with a hug and a radiant smile.
Strawberries!
Helen stirred the martini in its cut glass pitcher, but grinned at Ida over her shoulder.
Now I wish I had champagne to add to that.
Honey, if you're making martinis, we don't need to look any further.
I drifted at the edge of the room, suddenly aware that I was the only white woman present. I tucked my hands behind my back, as if hiding the color of my skin would distract anyone. Moments later, Helen delivered the martini and I had to untuck them. At least I had something to do with my hands now. 2, 3, 5, 7, 9, everything would be fine. Do you want me to set up the card table? Once we started playing cards, the tension would drop away.
Actually,
Helen poured another measure of gin into the pitcher.
I've invited you here under false pretenses.
Oh, dear. I swallowed, then sipped my martini and swallowed that, too. The sense of unease in my gut didn't go away. She poured in the vermouth while I exchanged glances with Ida and Florence. At least, they looked as confused as I felt.
Elma, you may already know about this,
Helen continued.
Not yet, but go on. At the last poker game that Reynard played with the boys, Governor Wargan mentioned the rocket crash. As we waited, she tossed in a couple of ice cubes and picked up a silver spoon to stir. The FBI is investigating whether Leonard Flannery had anything to do with it. I lowered my martini. They asked me about that. The clinking of the ice against the sides of the pitcher slowed as Helen stopped stirring and turned to stare at me. They? The FBI? A couple of weeks ago, they pulled Leonard and me out of a sim in the neutral buoyancy pool. They had a bunch of stupid questions about whether he could have brought the rocket down from inside. I told them that he wasn't and couldn't have been involved.
Well, apparently they have a witness who says that he was.
Helen tapped the spoon on the side of the glass and set it aside.
The hell you say?
Florence sat up on the sofa.
Who?
Helen shrugged. Reynard didn't think to ask. And Nathaniel hadn't thought to tell me about the conversation at all. When they asked me, they said that someone had reported on the conversation. A witness. So, someone on the ship. Right? Ida swore softly and strode over to the sidebar.
Better hurry up with that martini, because I can tell I'm not going to like the way this conversation is going to go.
I settled into one of the armchairs. What else did Reynard say? Concentrating on pouring the martinis into the glasses, Helen grimaced.
Apparently, Governor Wargan is concerned that if this business with the FBI gets out, the Congress might pull Leonard.
She set the pitcher down and turned to face the room.
And Florence.
What?
We all said it at pretty much the same time, surrounded by varying amounts of cursing. Florence slopped some of her whiskey and soda over the edge of her glass. As she mopped it up with a cocktail napkin, she said,
On what grounds?
You're both members of the NAACP, and so were all of the men who boarded the ship.
Helen shook her head and came to join us. Ida trailed after her.
So am I. So are most of the colored astronauts.
They asked about the pilot, too. I set my martini on the side table next to my handbag.
Okay, so let's work the problem.
Ida took a healthy swig of her martini and responded with the question astronauts ask when things go wrong in space.
Right. What's going to kill us next?
I'm about to kill someone, that's for sure.
Florence sat back on the couch.
But I'm guessing that my mouth is one of the problems.
Public opinion.
Helen sat down on the couch next to Florence.
That is what will kill us.
It had already killed Helen's shot at the Mars mission. I reached for my bag and dug out my notepad.
Okay, public opinion. What else?
Lies.
Florence shook her head.
We need to figure out who's lying about Leonard.
I scribbled that down as we began making a list of everything that could go wrong. And then Helen mixed more martinis, and we started finding solutions. I didn't get home until after midnight, but Nathaniel was still up. Or rather, he was awake and reading. He sat propped against all the pillows on our Murphy bed with a sheet draped across his legs. The pale blonde hair on his chest caught the amber lamplight like a cloud at sunset. He looked up and smiled.
I am angry at you.
That might have been my third martini speaking, but I set my handbag down on the kitchen table, kicked my shoes off, and went to stand on the new rug in my stocking feet. It really was gloriously soft, but the tufted oriental wonder did not diminish my irritation.
Or maybe irked.
He sat up, setting his book aside.
Why?
Because you didn't tell me about the FBI and Leonard and Florence.
Oh.
He threw the sheet off. He had no pajamas on beneath it. That was interesting, but would not distract me from the main issue. Nathaniel stood in his full nude glory.
Is that why Helen invited you over?
We are talking about why you didn't tell me.
Nathaniel sighed and gave a little shrug.
When?
When what?
When was I supposed to tell you?
He ran his hand through his hair so it stuck up, like gravity had stopped in his orbit.
You come home late. You leave before I wake up. At work?
I didn't leave before you woke up this morning. We went to synagogue together and had lunch. We spent most of today together before I went to Helen's.
Yes. Forgive me for wanting to spend a day with my wife instead of talking about work.
I rocked back a little.
We've always talked about work.
Nathaniel sighed again and covered his face with his hands.
I know.
When he peeled his hands away, his shoulders had sagged.
The truth is, I forgot by the time we got to the weekend.
You forgot? You forgot that the FBI is investigating two of my teammates?
Yes.
He leaned over and snatched his dressing gown from the back of the living room chair.
Believe it or not, I have other things on my mind than a conversation over a game of poker.
It's not just...
I know. I didn't ignore it. I told Clemens, all right?
He pulled the dressing gown on, tying the belt tight enough that it must have hurt.
You were already upset enough about Helen. I didn't think you needed more to feel guilty about.
My jaw dropped.
Guilty? Leonard and Florence aren't my fault. Why would I feel guilty?
You're Jewish. You're Southern. You feel guilty about being alive.
I snorted.
All right. All right. I'll grant you that point. That one point.
He dropped into the chair, leaning one elbow on the armrest.
Well, thank God for that.
Looking up at me, Nathaniel tilted his head to the side.
Look, Elma, there's nothing you can do about it, so...
Ha!
He sat up abruptly.
What are you planning?
I drew a circle on the carpet with my toe. It really was a glorious carpet, and maybe I should have stopped after martini number two.
Maybe I'll keep some secrets of my own.
It wasn't a... You know what? Fine.
He wiped the air with both hands.
Who won the bridge game?
We didn't play bridge.
Nathaniel stared at me. I'd seen him give this look to an engineer who failed to account for drag coefficient in a design concept. The only time I could remember being on the receiving end of that flat, slightly aggrieved expression was the time I'd turned his tuxedo shirt pink in the wash. Yes, I should have sent it to the cleaners, but I was trying to save money when we were newlyweds. The stare wasn't quite as good as Mama's had been, but it was darn close. I cleared my throat.
Do you really want to know? Are you just asking so you can shoot down the idea?
He blinked three or four times.
What?
Nathaniel shook his head, shoving himself to his feet, then stalked around the room until he returned to stand behind the chair that he'd been sitting in. Pressing both hands on the chair's back, he leaned all his weight on it.
When have I ever, ever stood in the way of what you wanted to do?
Heat discharged through my face like a rocket venting at separation. He hadn't. Ever. Not even when I wanted to leave him for 3 years to go harrying off to Mars. I'm sorry.
What are we fighting about?
I don't. I sat down, on the coffee table in front of the sofa, but I didn't really care at this point. I don't know. I just wanted you to have told me. Outside the window, one of the late-night streetcars clattered past over the tracks. I stared at my hands and knotted them together. My knuckles turned white from pressure. I shouldn't have had that third martini.
I'm sorry I didn't.
It was not entirely clear if he was apologizing or just that he regretted doing something we were fighting over. Pushing that question seemed inadvisable. I sighed, trying to vent some tension. You're right. I'm not spending enough time with you.
I know what the schedule is.
Across the room, cloth rustled as he shifted behind the chair.
And how much catch-up you have to do on top of that.
What did Clemens say?
That replacing Leonard wasn't an option. That he literally wrote the book on Martian geology and landing sites.
But not Florence. He shifted again. Not even a streetcar broke the silence in the room. My toes dug into the intricate patterns on the rug.
She wasn't even on the rocket.
She's been very outspoken about the inequalities at the IAC.
Nathaniel cleared his throat.
And there have been complaints.
I lifted my head. She and I didn't get along, but I had never voiced that to anyone except Nathaniel.
You didn't...
He scowled.
Who exactly do you think you're married to?
Sorry. Tilting his head back, Nathaniel stared at the ceiling and took a markedly slow breath. He pursed his lips as he blew it out, like one of Clemens's smoke rings.
Elma, I do not share our private conversations.
You did with the doctor?
No.
His gaze snapped down to me.
I fucking wanted to, but I did not. There are these vows that we made to each other. Remember those? I told the doctor about your physical symptoms, and that is all. The fact that you and Florence don't get along? Please.
I'm sorry. The weight of it all grabbed me and pulled my head down until it rested on my knees. I wrapped both arms around my head. I'm sorry.
Outside the confines of my arms, Nathaniel's feet scuffed across the carpet. A moment later, his hand made a mass-con of weight on my back. He kissed the crown of my head.
Why are you angry with me?
Because I could be. I ground my teeth against the thought, but it had already happened. Because you're here. Because I feel helpless. His sigh stirred the hair at the nape of my neck.
Me too.
I'm sorry.
You've said that.
A chuckle escaped me, and I used it to help me sit up. My eyes needed wiping, but at least I didn't have snot running down my face.
Well, I am. I shouldn't have taken it out on you.
And I should have found time to tell you.
He grimaced and looked off to the side.
I forgot how much you feel these things, which is stupid. Not you feeling them, but me forgetting.
I almost followed his train of thought.
What things?
Injustice.
He sat down on the carpet with his legs crossed and looked up at me.
So, what did you all figure out? What can we do about it?
Have I mentioned how lucky I am to be married to this man? The dressing gown had fallen open to show most of his chest and all of his calves. I reached out to run a hand down his cheek. We have an idea, but... Oh, this was why I was really angry. Nathaniel's raised eyebrows asked the question. I realized why I'm angry. My therapist would be so proud. I'd figured it out, even with a third martini. I feel angry because I feel guilty about what I'm about to ask for.
His gaze narrowed, but he held his tongue and gave me room to speak. The IAC is on American territory?
I swallowed. Lunetta isn't. He stared at me for a moment, so I saw the point when his trajectory of thought caught up with my apparent non sequitur, because the color drained out of his face.
Shit. All of you?
I nodded. Helen had figured it out before we'd even arrived. The only way to be certain that Florence and Leonard weren't pulled into endless meetings with the FBI and Congress was to get them out of that jurisdiction. With launch only 6 months away, Clemens could make the budgetary case that we couldn't replace a team member without pushing the mission out by a year and a half and causing enormous cost overruns. But if Clemens sent just Leonard and Florence to Lunetta, we couldn't continue to train together as a team, and the motive would be blatantly transparent. The entire First Mars Expedition team would need to go. Helen thinks I have to be there as the lady astronaut to guide public opinion about our reason for being on the station. Nathaniel groaned and fell back to the carpet, except he forgot that the Murphy bed was down and cracked his head against its steel frame.
Gah!
He curled over onto his side, grabbing the back of his head.
Shit!
I knelt by him with no memory of crossing the space between us. Are you all right?
Yeah.
He pulled a hand away and looked at it. No blood.
Just stupid.
I'll get some ice.
I'm fine.
I'll get some ice. Standing, I kept my gaze on him as if his head might suddenly spew blood across the carpet. You'll have a knot there. He sighed and pushed himself up to sit. His legs spread so that his dressing gown hid nothing. Yes, even in moments like this, I notice my husband's body. Nathaniel probed the back of his head with one hand.
I'm fine.
He is a brilliant rocket scientist and yet completely stupid sometimes. The apartment is so small that it took only a moment to go to the freezer and pull the ice tray out. The cold metal burned against my skin as I grabbed the handle and yanked on it to crack the ice in the tray into cubes. Grabbing a clean kitchen towel, I dumped the ice cubes into it.
Are you going to come home?
What? I turned with the towel wadded up in one hand.
Nothing.
He closed his eyes, still rubbing the spot on the back of his head. A breath.
After Mars, will you come home?
Yes. What a question. Did he think I would stay on Mars forever? His smile was pained. It might just have been the bump on his head. We both pretended it was.
Good.
I walked around the kitchen table and knelt to hand the ice to him. Here.
I'm fine.
But he took it and set the wadded-up cloth against the base of his head. See? I sat on the floor and leaned against him. I have to come home because someone has to stop you from being an idiot. He chuckled, wrapping an arm around my shoulders to pull me closer.
Does Helen have a plan, or do you need me to make the Lunetta assignment happen?
I nodded, my head sliding across the silk of his gown. Sorry.
Me too.
He kissed the top of my head.
But I'll do it anyway.
10.
Crew of Mars Expedition training in space. Kansas City, Kansas, July 18th, 1962. In 3 months at 9:32 a.m. Central Daylight Time, the dreams of centuries and the technologies of the decade should converge in a fiery, thunderous instant to launch 14 astronauts representing the United Nations toward man's first landing on another planet, Mars. Preparations for the epic 3-year journey to Mars and back continue to run smoothly and on schedule. At Launching Pad 39A, Colonel Stetson Parker, the Mars Expedition Commander, and his crew are blasting off to continue their training on Lunetta and in the Mars fleet itself, so that they will be free from worldly distractions as they complete preparations for the 34-million-mile mission.
Once we were on the station, I seriously wondered why this hadn't always been the plan. I mean, why stick us in the neutral buoyancy pool to simulate zero-G when we could practice in actual zero-gravity? Well, I mean, besides the obvious fact that it was a lot easier to die in space. But other than that, everything got easier. I aimed my sextant out the observation window at real stars. The tiny variations in color that might have been hidden by the atmosphere of the Earth even before the meteor blazed with crystalline wonder from the velvet blackness of the sky. There were thousands, hundreds of thousands more stars visible in space than at even the best planetarium on Earth. And yet the job of picking out one star from a sea of them was easier. I registered Alcade and Spica, spun down to side on Earth, and presto changeo. I had the coordinates I needed to confirm our state vector. I scribbled down the answer. +0771145, +2085346, -0116167, -15115, +04514, -19587. Finished! Behind me, Parker clicked a stopwatch.
Best time yet.
A snort came from one of the observers floating behind us. Even before his South African drawl began, I was pretty sure it would be Vanderbilt De Beer.
She could write down any random memorized coordinates, and still you would believe.
Heidi Fogeli, the Pinta's nav comp, shut her notebook with a snap.
Please, De Beer, you know better than that.
She took a linen handkerchief to her finely tooled Swiss sextant. I'll admit to some envy for the beautiful stainless steel wonder. It had a built-in slot for a pin, a fold-out stopwatch that you could set to keep track of time elapsed, and really lovely, completely superfluous, engraving on the support.